Hey, this is Jocko Howard, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Oh, God. Hello, everybody. Hi. How are you? Good morning.
Good afternoon. Good evening. Mike, how are you?
I am Scott. That is Mike. How's it going? Welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. I think I know what that
is. You cut out there at the last second.
Oh, I said I think I nailed it all. That was everything you would put into a name.
That's you. That's me. We named the show. Yeah, I think we're good. I don't even think we need to talk. We'll just sit here for 20 minutes until our interview starts.
All right. We're 31 seconds in. Guys, if you want to check out the button. No. I'm sorry. I don't know. My brain scrambled. Like, we don't have to name names, right? We don't have to name names, but we can talk about, we can talk about some of the interviews we've had on this show. Mm. Like, let's peel back the fourth wall, if you will, the third wall, fourth wall, some wall. We're peeling down a wall, is what I'm saying.
Mm.
So we, you know, occasionally people reach out to us to be on the show. It's not always us. Just and sorry, guys. Before I'm not actually in a bad mood. I do want to say welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. We're a weekly podcast, twice a week lately. A lot of really great guests. Go check them out. Welcome to the show. Hi.
A lot of great guests. Let's talk about others.
Yeah. sorry, I needed a large sip of alcohol after that interview. So occasionally people do reach out to us to be on the show, and we love when people reach out and want to be on the show or recommend people or have guests, but... Well, I'm sorry. We're not interesting all the time, and a lot of people aren't really that interesting to come on a show for a half hour.
Yeah, there are times where we have a guest on the show. I would say probably around like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we'll be chatting, just making sure. Okay, we'll start at this time, do some banner, do the interview, blah blah blah, set up our schedule. And it would just be like, I don't know what to ask. I can't find anything. I don't know what to say in this conversation.
Right. It's like, okay. It's like if some big show or, wow, that not a big show. If some show was like, we're going to bring Scott on, right? He's a comic and a radio host. Like, I wouldn't even feel that confident going on, going on that show and really like being able to really talk about myself, right? Like if the interview was about just me, I wouldn't really like it because I don't think I have enough like stuff to talk about. Like, yeah, we've been doing this for a long time, but what does that mean? If it was just like I would sit in on panel and it was just discussion, I'd be okay with that, right? But like
a general topic,
right,
kind of conversation.
Yeah, like if someone was like, we want to interview you about comedy and podcast, I'm like, bro, I am the same as the rest of you. Like, I am not anywhere further than anybody else.
And, Scott, what's it like talking into a mic?
Yeah. I mean, we've interviewed some cool guests, but that's them, right? That's not us.
Yeah.
Like, no one's like, oh, my God, the interview was so great. Let's interview the host. They want to interview the person we interviewed, you know? So my point being is sometimes people don't need their own interviews on shows. Like, you know, like we're sometimes at the point where we get sent guests where it's like, oh, let's interview Mike. He landscaped my dad's lawn last week. It was unbelievable work. Let's bring Mike on. Now, Mike might be an amazing landscaper or he might do amazing drapes, but maybe he's not the best for entertainment radio.
Yeah, there are certain people. Podcasts are built for when you have a bunch of free time where you want to hear something interesting in the background, maybe driving and listening to something interesting.
Yard work.
Yeah, these are once in a while, there's a person where you just sit back and go, okay, nobody has been bored enough to listen to this moment.
Listen, even we've had some really interesting people where they're a little long-winded, you know? And like, we're like, well, maybe we got to cut some of this because no one's going to listen to this for 90 minutes straight, you know? And we try to keep our episode... No, let me... If you're just tuning in, we
avoid everything we say and listen to every episode.
Yeah. No, our general format of the show, especially over the last two years, where the show is basically around 90 minutes, and it's usually about a half hour of us chatting up about life and news and whatever's going on with a guest in the middle, and then usually on the outro playing some kind of game or again talking about life and wrap it up, right? That's kind of the way the format has fallen. That's the way we like the show. That's the way I think the show works best, right around that 90-minute mark. No one really wants to hear anybody on our little show for longer than like an hour. You know, I think an hour is a good, is more than enough, unless the person's like, unless we get like Joe Rogan on the show, yeah. You know, or someone massively big. Even then, you got to be interesting to hold people's attention for that long.
Well, I had him for the show, but then he's like, well, I host a podcast and you don't interview the host, as you pointed out earlier, so that's why he declined.
See, you told me that he canceled because we told him we wouldn't promote his show on the cast, like we wouldn't we conflict of interest, we thought.
Well, I mean, I tried to get him into like some of our podcast networks and they weren't interested. I got to
really
be honest with you. Yeah.
So the BS Podcast Network and DCN and Denville Radio, they didn't want Rogan, huh?
Coming right up. All of them are like, we got no space for this rookie.
It's interesting.
We don't know what he really holds. And some people are like, I watched News Radio. It was an all right show. Yeah. I don't need to bring him on for our series of podcasts. So
no one really wanted his like 30 million listens per episode at all, really.
I think he bloats it a little. You know, maybe 32 million if you want to push it. But 33, come on. We're talking real talk here. It's Mike and Scott getting real here on Verbal Shenanigans.
We're like R. Kelly. Real talk. Real talk. How you gonna burn my clothes? Real talk. But yes, it takes... Ah, man. I mean, if those episodes do come out, guys, and you're hearing this and you do listen to them down the line, please send me like, hey, I know what episode you're talking about, because you could probably hear it in my voice or Mike's voice. I know we mentioned last week, like Mike does say, we'll give you a hint, Mike does say fantastic in one of those interviews and did not mean the word fantastic whatsoever.
I thought I said fascinating.
Oh.
Well, was it fantastic? I thought it was fascinating.
I think it might be fascinating. I think you might be right.
Yeah.
But fantastic is definitely not something you wouldn't say either. So, I've also caught you saying interesting.
Yeah.
But
yeah, there are times where I just zone out and I'm like, I'm guessing my time to ask a question is coming up, and it's just the only way I can really. Sometimes I need that extra 5 seconds to figure out what I'm going to say. So interesting,
fascinating.
So what do you do again?
So you ever play music like your granddad? Well, in his bio, it says...
I was a drummer for Creedence.
Meanwhile, the guy we interviewed, his bio says he was a musician for like 30 years. Well, I missed that point. Hey, what are you going to do?
Well, I knew you played drums, but did you ever not play drums?
That's like a couple weeks ago or a couple episodes ago. I asked the Buckleys if they were... If
related.
How they met each other, and they're like, oh, well, we're related.
Yeah. When I came downstairs one day, I'm like, there they are.
Listen, we can't be, you know, we're just regular guys. We can't be super prepared for every interview or any interview. But no, listen, when we got someone good on the show, I think we do a good job preparing and being into it. So you guys could be the judge, whatever. You know, it's not our fault. It's really not our fault. You're the one.
And you got to try for some of these people, because once in a while you get that diamond in the rough, man. I mean, we called the Lucy Sprogan Award that just because, like, we didn't know her that well going into it, but it was a very delightful interview chatting with
her. For sure. Probably in our top 25, man.
Yeah. Snake Milker. We went into it just saying this is just going to be a quick inside joke between me and Scott, and it came as one of the most insane Balls to the Walls episodes ever, maybe top five ever, I would say.
And they also always seem to be promoting our podcast. So Snake Milk for life. Woo! Also, Lucy Spraggan, side note, is jacked all at this last year. She's gigantic.
That girl's ripped, man. That's one of those, like, you're in a bar and you say something, and she's like, that's not appropriate. Don't be doing that. No, what are you going to do? And she could just, like, whack you with a left, and you just, like, ow.
So, shifting gears. Let's shift gears. Sorry to the guests that we're disrespecting right now, but we're just being honest. We're honest here on the show. We like to we like to spread honesty, and that's all we can do. Mike, are you familiar with the term dickering?
Dickering?
Dickering. D-I-C-K-E-R-I-N-G.
I've tinkered. I never...
You've tinkered in dickering?
Yeah, I've tinkered. I haven't dickered.
Okay. Okay. So I'll have to... Okay, go into this for a little bit. Now, I have not watched much TV at all during this quarantine. You would think I'd be watching a lot. I actually would go out on a limb and say I've watched less, because a lot of times during regular work cycle, I'd come home, do my gym thing, dinner, and then I'd be dead at night and like want to watch TV. Now it's like I'm kind of tinkering. There you go, Mike. During the day with some yard work, and then I'll work out, and then I'll sit for a little while, and then I'll eat. Like, my schedule's all off. And then by the nighttime, I'm like, I'm not ready to, like, sit down and just kind of, I don't know, just veg for an hour. I've never been really that good for it, like, at that at all. But, so, a friend had told me, he's like, he's probably Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And,
all right. Amish country.
Yes. So he told me, he's like, I caught this show on Amazon Prime. It used to be on the History Channel called Down East Dickering. I'm like, what? And you could picture some of the dumb jokes that had come out of that, right? And I'm like, Down East Dickering. And I kind of, whatever. And he explains it to me, and I'll explain that in a second. And I put it into, like, you know, the useless part of my memory that, you know, cool. Like, it's never, you're never going to come back again. So then I just put on Prime, I'm eating my lunch, and I come across the show, Down East Dickering. And I'm like, all right, I remember him talking about this. Let me check it out. Now, dickering is, dickering means like haggling and bargaining and trading. So if me and you, Mike, were dickering about this hat I was selling you, right, we would dicker back and forth, and you would try to get a lower price. So essentially along the lines of those, like all those shows like Pawn Stars and American Pickers and Storage War, which I am guilty of going down rabbit holes with those shows. Not because they're like the greatest, most intellectual, amazing shows, but they're like that nice comfort zone of TV for like men, that's mostly men, but maybe I'm being a little sexist there, but it's just like, for whatever reason, it just hits that like calm mark. Like, oh, this is interesting and kind of mindless, right?
Okay.
Like, have you been ever sucked into those? Like any of those, this Pawn Stars, Storage Wars, anything like that?
Don't get into them. I think they come off a little too fake for me, where it's like, all right, you guys do about 20 some odd episodes a season. You're in your like ninth season. You're telling me 180 times you just happen to open up a storage bin that has something worth like 10 grand in it.
Yeah.
It's like somebody who had a 10 grand item decided not to pay $200 for the storage bin, and you magically figured out it's in there and went all that. That's,
I would agree.
That's the kind of stuff that just, I mean, like, go, you know what? I don't even want to play it. Now, granted, I do watch some reality TV. I like the Gordon Ramsay stuff, the cooking shows. And even in those, I could sit back and go, all right, I could tell you stage some of this stuff. But right. I think it's enough where I have the interest in what they're cooking and stuff like that, where I'm like, all right, I can set aside how fake some of this stuff is to enjoy
premise. A little mindless, right? Yeah. And I would agree, like Storage Wars and Pawn Stars, I think were like the two that were really like, damn, this is like super fake after a while. Like, let me call an expert, like all that stuff. And then I thought like American Pickers, I thought was always kind of like, it seemed like kind of realistic because it was never anything like too big, you know, like they're always like finding things for like $100 and selling them for $200. Like, I don't know. Either way. Okay. So Down East Dickering takes place in Maine. Okay. Way up Maine. And it's just basically these hillbillies, the rednecks of Maine, just going around. Like one guy's name is Codfish.
Oh, Cotter. What you doing, Cotter?
One guy's name is Yummy. One guy's name is Tony Bennett. That's his actual name. And they go around and they have the worst accents ever. Picture a Boston accent, but like way like twanger, like, oh, we're gonna go dickering. Oh, you know, I'm gonna park the car and have a party. Like that accent, but way worse. And I don't know what it was, man. I just got sucked into this show to the point where my wife's like, why are you watching? I'm like, I don't know. It's like kind of mindless. And I think it plays for a long time. I bought a lot of stuff on Craigslist and I've sold a lot of stuff and gotten some good things over the time. I think it taps into that interest for me. Like there's a hunt or there's a way to make a profit. Like, you know, like for a while I was scrapping. Like, I just kept the scrap pile. Never crazy. And I never went over the line with any of this. But, like, in my garage in my old house, I would just keep in the corner, like, metal I would find. And I would keep my aluminum can and go. And I'd make, you know, a truckload. I'd get $60 or something like that. And I was like, ah, you know? And, like, these guys are all in on that kind of lifestyle. And I don't know, man. It just, it just took off. I just, apparently, and then I had to do some background knowledge. Because that's what I do with every show. I ruin everything for myself. Like any like movie that's based on something real, I got to look it up, you know, and look what was real. Any documentary that I watch, I got to look what happened afterwards. You know, like I can't suspend disbelief. But I watched a show, the two seasons of it. It was on for two seasons. But apparently it's from 2014 or 15. I apparently just missed it along the way. But I don't know, man. I you ever get sucked into something that you know is not that great, but yet you can't stop. I remember one time I watched like a whole marathon of like Undercover Boss, and I don't think that's even a great show, but I remember just getting sucked into and just watching Shark Tank's another one, you know, like that's when you know it's good TV tech, like by definition, meaning that it gets people like me to watch.
I'm trying to think of anything I binged that was like really bad. I mean, I once in a while binge on Mythbusters, but I don't think that really goes into that category.
Yeah, like I had a couple binges on that at one point. Is Mythbusters still on? I feel like that's one of those shows that keeps coming back in like new iterations of it, but it's like, it's kind of gone.
I think they went like 12 seasons. Like it was just the two of them. Then they created the B team. Then I guess Discovery lost money, so they had to fire the B team. It was just Adam and Jamie.
Right.
Then it ended. Then they had like a reality show to decide who's the new Mythbusters, and I think they technically started the new Mythbusters series, but it only lasted like a year because nobody cared about the new people. They cared like about the old people. The
new Ghostbuster, it almost sounds like. Ugh. Like no one ever wants a new anything. Rarely does a new anything ever work, you know? Like
I can't I'm trying to think of it. Like what was something that got booted with somebody new and it worked, but
Black Sabbath was pretty good with Ronnie James Dio. But yeah, so I went down this wormhole, man, and I don't know. I mean, I did find out like some of them aren't from Maine, which I'm like, I'm okay with. Like the guys from Deadliest Catch. That's another one. Back in the day, I used to like a lot. We had Captain Phil on our show, by the way. No, Captain Wild Bill. Way back. That's going back a while now. I don't know. It's just something about that like urge to find. And I think that taps into kind of like, I don't know, what we're doing a little bit. Like finding, I think for me, I don't know about you, but getting some of like our guests, right? Is like, I don't really pay mind to the listens that much. I know I should. I don't pay mind like to go crazy with promotion and whatnot. But like my biggest thing is to land a guest. Like that's like the, to me, that's like the fun part of this. Like, yeah, obviously the talking and doing the show is, of course, the most fun. But second, 1A, 1 and 1A would be the hunt to find someone who would actually want to talk to us, you know? We're able to build this resume and our emails are getting stronger. I don't know. Like, there's something about it that I really like that part.
I think you get most excited when we get a guest good enough where you say we have to change the email where we are adding new guests.
Correct.
I know there's times like we have it and you're like, we got to change the email. And it's like, all right, whatever. And it's like 2 hours later, this is the new lineup. When you send an email, you send this and all.
Yeah.
It seems to be like 10 miles long. I don't think we ever technically eliminate people. We just add on.
But. Yeah. I thought about that too. We might have to have an elimination conversation.
Yeah.
Who doesn't make it. But, you know, it's a pretty – if I'm sending a resume out, that resume is pretty strong, man. And it's like,
it's pretty solid because it's big names and we get the solid weird kind of guest stuff. I will pat ourselves on the back for that. Like there's so many times like we tell the other one, I got blah, 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 and it's just laughter for like 5 minutes straight. Did you find them? And it's,
yeah, like next that, Monday.
That's almost more the story. It's just how I figured out, you know.
So you kind of have that too, right? You kind of have, like, that's kind of like some of the fun I'm having with the show is it's the hunt and the reveal, right? Like it's the hunt. And sometimes I'm like hiding it from you until I can tell you, like, I don't know, like either tell you through text or like through a picture or two times I've I was able to surprise you with both Duke's brothers, you know, like, so that was like really Duke's
brothers?
Really fun for me.
Whoa, Duke's brothers? Excuse me?
What?
They're number one, it's the Duke boys. Number two, they're cousins.
Oh, God. Sorry, Mike.
All right, everyone, I'm sorry. There's going to be no guests tonight. I have to drag out the Book of Dukes and re-educate Scott for the rest of the night.
The Book of Dukes.
There is no guest tonight, even though Scott is going to tell us who the next guest is. It's a ruse. I'm just going to educate him the rest of the night until I can solidly quiz him on stuff. Until he knows who played Coy Duke, I will not rest.
You're the only guy keeping that damn show alive. No, but you agree with me, right? Like, isn't that like part of the fun of doing this? Like a guest-driven show, it's like, oh my God, here comes the next guest, you know?
It's definitely a round robin of excitement. I mean, even like the ones that we fail on and eventually come back to. Like, it took me 4 years to get somebody Bigfoot enthusiasts on
took
the
me,
show.
Took me 2 years to get Howard Berger, not like a special effects guy, Howard Berger, just going back. And to me, like, the payoff is also what's always fun. Like, Howard Berger, one of my favorite episodes to date, would go in that top 25 is what I'm saying. Like, so it's funny. It's like the payoff is always kind of cool, or like the hunt. Or then sometimes it's so easy and other times it's so hard and annoying, and I think that's kind of the why I like it, because it's not easy.
Yeah, and I'm still liking trying to figure out like different weird guests and stuff. Like, I, for some reason, I'm obsessed with like getting some kind of like fire scientist or expert on the show. Yeah, I can't really explain why.
But that's okay, because that's what makes it fun. Like, I don't know. It's like I know that what's cool about it is I know that you're working on generally a different
angle,
a different thought line that I'm working on, because I'm working like somewhere else, you know, we're thinking. So it's pretty interesting who we are able to come up with. So
it's just entertaining. I'll say, hey, Scott, I got somebody who does that puppetry of the penis on the show, and just your reaction to,
yeah,
like the 10 questions that come afterward, like that still happens. Why did you look after that? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, as we approach our guest time right now, who's really interesting, I will say, if we didn't become, like some podcasts don't want get, if we didn't do the guest thing, I don't think we would have done this for 300 episodes.
No. We would have been sick of it a long time ago.
Yeah.
Like we were doing 2 a week earlier and that slowed down. So,
yeah, but it was just we were still finding our footing, like on what this show was and the format and whatnot. But Berlo, I think it is, and that we'll talk a little bit more after this because I do want to talk about dickering for a little bit more. But who we got tonight?
Scott, tonight we're going to be talking with Jack O'Halloran. You may know him as a former boxer who has been in the ring with George Foreman and Ken Norton, also a Hall of Famer in California for his boxing career. Or you may know him for his acting career, where he's been in King Kong, Dragnet, The Flintstones, or most notably, Non in Superman 1 and 2.
Absolutely. And if you see this face, you guys have probably recognized him from various movies and different roles and whatnot. So let's get Jack on the line.
Hey, Jack, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you good.
Hey, Jack, how's it going?
Good.
Awesome. Yeah, I can hear you pretty good.
Yep. That's Scott, and this is Mike here from Verbal Shenanigans. Where are we calling you from tonight, Jack?
Me, myself, I'm in Redondo Beach, California.
Oh, nice, nice. As we start all these interviews, unfortunately, lately, I got to kind of ask the question, how things been going with everything with this pandemic with you and your family?
Well, you know, other than being confined, it's not bad. You know, it's thank God we like each other.
Yeah, right.
You know, so yeah. But I've been doing a lot of work keeping pieces together because we have several projects underway. So we're just keeping all the bullheads together until this thing frees up and people can move around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Knock on wood, it's sometime soon.
So, Jack, I want to start with like your early career, talking about your times in boxing. Just kind of what drove you into the love of the sport? Was it a family member, or was it just the love of watching the sport on TV?
Well, you know, from the time I was a youngster, I always was intrigued with boxing. You know, I learned how to fight, and I was quite handy in the street, and somebody taught me well. And but I got into football, and you know, in high school I was in track and basketball and football, and then I went all the way up to playing pro ball, and I got a little disenchanted with when they hired Joe Kuharik as a coach in Philadelphia, and Ali had just won the title, so I said to some people, you know, I can beat that guy. They said, wow, what a great idea. Let's put you in the gym. So there I went. And I could never box amateur because I was already considered professional. So I think I'm one of 10 heavyweights in the history of the business that got ranked heavyweight in the top rankings without boxing amateur, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty insane.
Now, when you jump into boxing, like as far as getting to the level you got, is this an everyday thing? Is this a, you know, after school kind of thing?
It, no, okay. It was my day job. I really put my soul into it when I first started, and then they told me that I was about 16-0, I think, and they said that I had to do a physical one time, and they told me about I had a disease called acromegaly, which is a tumor of the pituitary gland, and that I shouldn't be fighting at all. They didn't know how I was doing it. So, of course, being a hard-headed street kid and some Italian blood in me, I said, No, I think I'll just keep on going. Thank you very much. Because it was a good day job. But, I would box every week. I didn't care. If I ever went to camp like Fighters Today and even Ali, and I told Ali that one time, if I ever went to camp for 2 or 3 weeks like that or a month, nobody would have ever touched me. You know, but because you're getting focused and everything else. And I proved that I went to took a fight in South Africa once, and I was down there for like a month and a half, and I boxed there, and then a week later I knocked out the number two heavyweight in the world in LA, Manuel Ramos.
I mean, that's crazy, you know. I mean, nowadays boxers or even like UFC fighters, they take probably at minimum like 4 months before they get into a fight. Is it just simply it's natural to you, or you think you just
it was just different? I had a natural ability that I really abused. You know, I had a natural talent, and God gave me a talent. And I fought 1 year 20 some times, which was unheard of. You know, there's like about 25 fights of mine that aren't even in my record. I have like 25 knockouts. So I went. They used to have a lot of shows up in New England. A guy named Sam Silverman had shows all over the place. So we all used to travel around and drive up to these shows and stuff and see different fighters. And it was like a clique of people. And they would say, "You got your shoes with you, man? We're short of a bout," and da da da. And I'd say, "Well, can't tell my management." "No, well, you fight under another name. No problem." Yeah. So I did that a lot, you know. And in those days, you fought. When you were fighting in the early days, you got $10 a round, you know.
$10 a round, wow.
Money. You know, you weren't fighting for the money. You were just fighting because you like fighting. And no, there wasn't real money in boxing until Ali.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, were you like, you know, you hear a lot of story of boxers and, you know, a lot of boxers get into it to kind of keep them on the straight and narrow path, to keep them out of trouble. Did boxing do that for you? Or, you know?
No, I got more trouble when I was coming out. You got to understand where I come from. You know, my father was the most powerful Italian that ever came into the country. Albert Anastasia. He ran a little company called Murder Incorporated.
Jeez.
Ooh. Out of New York. And he was partners with Luciana and Meyer Lansky and Frank Costello, and you know, so I had a lot of mentors in my life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like interesting, I noticed, like looking at your record, not only were you did knockouts and all, there was a lot of fights that went to like the last round. That's something we didn't really see with boxing in the, like the 80s and 90s with the heavyweights. Is it just bad training or not enough heart into it? What do you think?
I like to fight. You know, I like fighting. And I remember when I was fighting, I tell you, funny story. They called me up. I was in New Jersey one time, and they called me up to fight a guy, Terry Daniels, in Houston, Texas. They were looking for a fight for Frazier to defend his title in Houston, Texas. And so I went down, and this guy Lou Viscusi was a big time promoter. And I went to Houston, and I got off the plane, and he said, "My God, you're in great shape." And I said, "Well, aren't you supposed to be in shape, man?" You know, but I was house ridden for about 3 or 4 weeks. So I was training every day. I couldn't leave. We had some indictments for union problems, and it was better to stay home than be out and about. So I got in very good shape, and I beat Terry Daniels. I destroyed him in 3 rounds. And he was a ranked fighter, and they were shocked, you know. So I flew back to Philadelphia with Yank Durham on the plane, and he said to me, "If you beat one more good fighter, you can have the Frazier fight." I said, "Well, I'll do better than that. You just name the fighter and the place and send me a ticket." He said, "Are you serious?" I said, "Yeah, just name the fighter and whatever fighter satisfies your guys, and, you know, name the place when we're going to fight and send me a ticket." So they called me a week or two later and said, "You're fighting Cleveland Williams in Houston, Texas." And Houston was his hometown. And Cleveland was a world-ranked fighter, a pretty good fighter. And and I destroyed him. I went down there and I just, in fact, the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th round, I was hitting him. I was holding him up. I kept grabbing him under the elbows and said, "Don't be falling down on me tonight, sonny. We've been dancing all night." And which helped his career, because if you went the distance, it wasn't as bad as getting knocked out, you know? So, but I was in great shape, thank God, because in the third round, he hit me a left hook. Oh, my God, my toes shook. I fell back on the ropes. He came charging. I thumbed him and cuffed him, spun him around. I whispered in his ear, "Never again tonight, sonny. You will never touch me again." And I just gave him a boxing lesson. But he was a hell of a fighter. And then no one would fight me. And Terry Daniels got the Frazier fight. And Cleveland fought George Savallo in the same card.
Now, you have tons of fights. Like you said, you have fights that aren't even on your record or whatnot. Who was your toughest opponent? You know, like, I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but who was the guy that gave you, you know, the biggest fight of your career?
I'll tell you, Norton and I had a great fight. I beat Norton bad in San Diego. They gave him a hometown decision, which was kind of irky. But I won the city, so I stayed there. And I knocked out a few people and became heavyweight champion of California. I beat Henry Clark, who no one wanted to fight. But Norton was a good fight. Foreman and I had a good fight until I walked into a punch, which was my own fault. Right. But I got up, and they stopped the fight right away, which is kind of shitty, you know.
They
were looking for a reason to stop it, because the first five rounds I was beating them three out of. So, you know, George was a good fighter. And there was a couple guys who were pretty down good. I mean, I fought a kid in England who was a really good boxer, Carl Gizzi. He was the champ of Wales. And I beat him in the Grosvenor House. And he was one of the few people that ever cut me. That ever gave me a cut, eye cut. Wow. Yeah, he was a pretty good fighter. But, you know, it's hard to say who. I fought a lot of tough guys, you know, that were rumblers. Yeah. Some guys that were boxers. And, you know, I walked into a few punches I shouldn't have walked into. And the disease of acromegaly had a big effect. Some days I wasn't fit to go in the ring. Mentally, you know, like, it was a very depressing disease. But I went anyway, because that's just the way I was.
Right.
I enjoyed the sport. I really did. I kind of liked it a lot. Then I, just to show the skill that I had, when I retired, I took a young man, Frankie Lyles, and I made him super middleweight champion of the world. I trained and managed him and then I developed Freddie Roach.
Oh, wow.
Where Freddie Roach got his international acclaim. He worked the corner with us.
What was the final straw? Like, when did you decide retirement was the right move?
I finally went to the hospital after doctors kept bugging the hell out of me, and I got the tumor taken care of at the Mass General Hospital, and they had a thing up there called a cyclotron proton machine, which was superb. And it was like a laser beam without burning you, and exploded the tumor. And I was 1 in 100 that did it the first time out. So I had the scabs in my head where they bolted me to this machine and all. And I checked out of the hospital and went down to Baltimore and fought the number 2 ranked heavyweight, Larry Middleton. And I trained one day for the fight. I came out of a hospital bed. How crazy is that, huh?
Yeah.
Doctor thought I was nuts. But so when I lost that fight, I said, you know what? I think it's time to. And I retired, and then they came to me. Because they had been trying to get me in the film business from 66 on. I kept turning them down. And they came to me for a film with Robert Mitchum, Farewell, My Lover. And I said, you know what? I think it's time. And I went out to Hollywood. I did a screen test, and Mitchum said it's either him or I will do the movie. So I blame it all on Robert Mitchum.
So when they bring you in for this stuff, are you – like, naturally into this? Are you excited? Do you take some acting classes before you go in there, or is it?
I never took an acting class, and I had to tell you, I was doing Farewell, My Lovely, and I think we were working about 3 or 4 weeks. And I came out of Goldwyn Studios one day, and I was going by the editor's room. And the editor on the picture was an Oscar winner, a super guy. And he grabbed me, and he said, Jack, he said, you never worked before? And I said, nope, this is the first time out of the box. He said, well, I'm sitting here editing this picture, kid. He said, I gotta tell you something. You're going to be a huge star. I said, oh, thank you very much. So I went and saw Mitchum, and I said, maybe I should go to UCLA and take some elocution lessons or some kind of acting lessons or something. And he laughed like hell. He said, stick with me, kid, and you'll fart through silk. Don't worry about that. And he said, they'll either ruin you or you'll ruin them. So I just went under the guidance that he gave me, and here I be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you get into acting, is it a totally different kind of mindset going from, you know, a sport where you're punching people in the face and trying to survive?
Sports gave me the timing factor.
Right.
Sports, boxing especially, gave me the timing factor. So I had great timing. And I said to Mitchum one time, I remember the very first shot that I ever shot in my life, you know, and they were moving the cameras, they were done, and I looked at him and I said, what is going on here? He said, you really don't know. I said, well, what am I asking you for? He said, that's it, kid. I said, that's all there is to this stuff? I said, yeah. I said, man, I'm a star. This is, are you kidding me? Because he and I had a great relationship. And yeah, that became the tagline of the movie. And, you know, I asked him one day, I said, you know, what is the definition of a star? And he said, it's one word, Jack, presence. You either have it or you don't. And the camera either loves you or it doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, he says, like Brando. Brando could do a picture, any role, doesn't make any difference. You'll come out of the theater and you'll say, boy, wasn't Marlon great there? What, there wasn't Marlon great here? Not even thinking of the name of the character, just that it's Marlon Brando. Because he had that presence. Gregory Peck had it. Mitchum had it. Certain actors, or you could go see a guy who's a pretty good actor, William Holden, and see a picture and then walk out of the theater and say, boy, he was really good at, what's his name? You know? So the word presence is the camera loves you, and you never look for the camera, it finds you. So you learn the technical sides of it, and I learned that from Mitchum, and it worked out very well. You know, I enjoyed it. You know, it's like, it was a natural thing for me, because I've been playing roles all my life, you know? When you're in the streets and you're surviving, and you know, you learn how to become a chameleon real well.
Mm. Now, they bring you in a lot of these roles as being like the big tough guy. Just out of curiosity, when you have a whole career where you're just used to beating people up, do they have to like whisper in your ear, okay, like when you pick up an actor, be gentle with this guy, you know, don't get rough with him if you're in a fight scene or anything like that?
Do you ever see Farewell, My Lovely?
Can't say I have, sorry.
You should. It's a great movie. But there's a scene in there where I have this huge guy up on the wall and I'm strangling him. You know, I'm supposed to be strangling him. You know, boom. And I got my hands around his neck. And Mitchum said to me, Jack, dig your fingers into his neck so they can see the whites of your knuckles. So it looks like you're really... I said, Robert, I said, you know, I don't want to hurt this guy. He said, Jack, he's an extra. Don't worry about it.
we got plenty of them.
It's just, you get into what you're doing. And it wasn't hard for me because I've been there, done that. So,
yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago, we had Michael Bent on, and you know, he was a former fighter and also got into acting, several roles, and he gets called in oftentimes to kind of work on choreography and kind of movies with fighting and things like that. What do you think it is about? I don't know. It seems like boxers always seem to be called in on these writing roles, or people get a perspective of the mind of a boxer. Why do you think that is? Just, I guess, forever. I don't know. It seems to be forever fascinating in Hollywood, for sure.
It's a very tough mindset. I mean, Jack Palance was a fighter. Mitchum was a boxer. there's a lot of them that did some boxing, and you know, it's a mindset that you, it's like a discipline that you put in your head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could train 2 days and go 10 rounds on my head, not a problem.
Right.
You know, it's just and so imagine if I trained 4 weeks and got in really good shape. My God, whoever I was going 10 rounds with was in serious trouble.
Yeah, I think it's like a timeless. I don't know. There's something always very intriguing about the story of a fighter, the story of up and coming boxers, fighters. You know, and it's like every 10 years or every 5 years, it's like a good movie that comes out. You know, regarding boxers and stuff. So it's pretty fascinating that it still holds up today.
Well, it's, you know, there's a lot of reality to it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you got to understand. There's only a couple sports that when they ring that bell, you're on your own.
Yeah.
And swimming's the same way. When you dive in that pool, you're on your own. You know, football, they can pull you out, put somebody else in, and you know, if you get an injury or something. But if you get an injury in the middle of a round, you're either fighting or you're quitting. You're on your own. You pull a muscle, you know, if you're going to quit, you sit on a stool. Yeah. But if you're a fighter, you say, the hell with this. I mean, I fought with broken hands and everything. So you just do what you got to do.
So I want to get to your role in Superman playing Nan. I looked up some stuff and I found it fascinating how you talked about how you were inspired to take the role because of Jackie Gleason. Can you get into a little about that?
When I went to see Donner, and he asked me, I read the script and all, and he said, you know, how do you feel about playing a mute guy? And I said, I embrace it. He said, really? I said, yeah, because Jackie Gleason was a friend of mine, and he did a picture of Zigo, and he won an Oscar for it. And I said, if I ever got a chance to play a person that I had to use facial and body expressions, I would embrace doing it. And here I am in the picture where Terrence is a vicious general, Sarah is a man-eater, and somebody had to relate to the children in the audience because it was a big child audience movie. So I said, I'm going to take this brutish, big brutish guy and play him like a child. You know, learning how to work my eyes and stuff like that, and with child mannerisms. And it worked very well. I mean, at least I think it did.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. No doubt. Just out of curiosity, were you around with the whole Richard Donner thing when they removed him? And
that was such bullshit. I mean, excuse my language, but that, you know, that should have never happened. That's assault kinds. That just shows you the unprofessionalism of producers. That, I mean, if Richard Donner would have finished two, he'd have done 3, 4, 5, and 6. Would have been a different franchise altogether.
Yeah.
They removed him because they owed Lester a picture, and they didn't want to pay Donner. I mean, how do you cut Marlon Brando out of a movie?
Yeah.
And Brando had already shot the footage. You know, he was already done working. So it was just, they didn't want to pay him the points.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
You know, and when you see the Donner cut, which I think is so much better, and Brando's all through it, well, that's because those scenes were already shot.
Yeah. Jack, in a million years, did you ever think you would be, you'd be kind of a legend in boxing, in the Boxing Hall of Fame, but also someone people are lining up for to go see at Comic Cons and things like that's two very opposite worlds, but yet you're a very prominent figure in both of those.
You know, I've been really fortunate in my life. Everything I've ever tried, I've done well at, and I guess it's just the attitude and the way I was taught as a child, a young man. And, but I, you know, football, I did well, boxing, I did well. The film industry, I did well. I write well. I'm a published author. We're getting ready to, do the books that I've written, in the films. And I produced the film and getting ready to produce a few more. I just have this very positive deal that, doing what I want to do whenever I want to do it. You know, it was like, even when I was a kid in Philadelphia coming up, it was an era where there was a lot of groups, singing groups and all. And I was part of the original Danny and the Juniors. I don't know if you remember who they were, but they did At the Hop.
Yeah.
And we were all used to stand on the corner and sing all the time, you know. And they and I remember going home and telling my mother, wow, we got a record deal and I'm quitting school. She said, guess what? You just quit the music business. Stay in school.
Right.
Not quitting school, son. Yeah. So there were two of us that had that situation where parents said, no, I don't think so. The only one that was actually graduated out of the group was Dave White, who was the writer. Danny Rapp was still in junior high school. You know, it's, but, you know, you just go through life and, you know, if you really want to do something, you do it.
Yeah.
I hear you. Now, as I said before, you've done a lot of, like, roles where you're, like, the brooding guy, but you were also pretty good in comedy. I'm just kind of curious, what kind of direction did you get in Dragnet when they said the scene is somebody's got Tom Hanks is going to smash your balls into a drawer?
Well, you know, they talked to me before that I reread the scene, and they when we did that scene, Tom Hanks was in awe. He just couldn't believe that I projected that type of ferocity and stuff, and then switched over to, yeah, you know, having your balls smashed, being able to act the other way around, and it worked really well. I mean, it was they were a pleasure to work with. It was Tom's breakout picture, and he's a super guy, and Danny Aykroyd's Danny Aykroyd. I mean, you could watch Drag Night 50 times, and you still wouldn't get all the one-liners that he threw around.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, comedy was very good at it. You know, we did a lot of neat stuff, and it came very natural. It was really good.
So, Jack, what are you working on these days? I know you were mentioning a book and whatnot. What should fans of yours look forward to? I
wrote a book called Family Legacy, and it's about 100 stories above The Godfather. It tells the truth about a lot of things in the country in New York and my father's world, and and it starts from my father's death to Kennedy's death, and I tell the truth about the Kennedy assassination. So, you know, I sat down with some friends of mine, and I'm going to do 3 more books, and we're going to tell the truth about a lot of things that happened in the country. And, you know, it's like Hollywood takes liberties, and so does book writers. And they, you know, like, they just did a picture of The Irishman. And I knew Frank Sheeran very well. He's from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
He was the driver for Hoffa and his, you know, and I knew Buffalino very well. And I knew his nephew, who was Hoffa's lawyer. Frank Sheeran never killed Hoffa, and he never shot Joey Gallo.
Yeah.
So there was 2 fallacies that they put in the movie right off the get-go for me, which made me very angry, but it was well acted. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Gina, but, I mean, Russell Buffalino turned over in his grave if he saw how they portrayed him.
Really?
And so would Hoffa, you know. But I knew Jimmy well, and trust me, he wasn't killed by Frank Sheeran.
Now, out of curiosity, I always find it fascinating when like stories come out from like mafia and stuff like that. I'm just kind of curious: do you have to go through certain people to like talk about stories and not agitate like the old school people, or is it just some like unwritten rule, like after a certain amount of time you could talk about these things?
Well, let me tell you this way. I am an old school person. You know, I'm 77 years old. So, and I have the right to use any name I want because of my family connection. And I've been a NAID kid since I was 19 years old. So I've lived under America all my life.
Right.
And I've done a lot of things in my life, and, when I wrote the book, they would never let me write it nonfiction. The government said, you'll never get it produced. We won't allow it. So we changed a couple things around. I took the name Jack Pagano in the book so that, because there's some statute of limitations, it just never cease, you know. So, but I'm one of, I mean, all my friends that I was raised with and all that did 30 and 40 years in jail. And I never did any time. I was very lucky, and I listened to people, and I handled my business in the proper manner. And, you know, it's all about how you play the game, you know?
Gotcha.
But well, I know things that happened in the country, and I know things that happened, you know, in our society. And, you know, like when I was a kid and we were raised in Philadelphia, we never locked our front door.
Right.
Nobody ever broke into our house. Nobody, you know, kids played in the street from sun up to sundown. And people didn't bother. We didn't have drive-by shootings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because the neighborhoods were protected by the dons that ran them. And they took care of people. It was a whole different scenario. You know, there was you wouldn't think of committing certain crimes because somebody would hand your ass to you, boy. You know, you just wouldn't do it. So that started, saw the changes, how things changed and how society changed. And from the Kennedy era on, how a lot of things change, you know. So when they do these mob pictures, and it's amazing, you know, Hollywood's a funny place. You, no one has a crystal ball to tell you what's going to make money. But the only genre that has been consistent in making money is organized crime pictures.
Yeah.
And even the spoofs make money. So, I watch these movies and I say, you know, nobody really looks at the truth to where in the very beginning, the government, industry, organized crime, and unions were all partners.
Mm-hmm.
And the organized crime guys weren't in the drug business. They were in gambling and loan sharking and extortion. And if you didn't have money, how could you pay them? So they made sure you went to work. So they took a lot of money and they put it into the growth of a country. My father ran all the waterfronts. There was always jobs for people. They had construction companies. They had, you know, they invested in General Electric. They invested in insurance companies. They invested in the growth of a nation. No one's ever told that story, so we're going to do that.
That's awesome. Jack, we really appreciate speaking with you about your life and things you're doing now. If people want to find out about your about what you're up to and find out the current status of your books, where can they go to?
FamilyLegacyTheNovel.com.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Called FamilyLegacyTheNovel.com. And that takes a good site, and then it takes you right to Amazon where the books are at. And, you know, it's all good, guys.
Yeah. Jack, awesome. Thank you. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for, sharing your story. I could talk to you for hours because you have endless stories in multiple different worlds. So I appreciate the time.
Hey, it's my pleasure, guys.
All right, Mike. Once again, I do want to. We have to arrange the Verbal Shenanigans Tournament of Death. As far as put all the tough guys in the show and maybe like a couple, whatever, and we'll just we're gonna debate who would actually win the fighting bracket. And Jack O'Halloran, and I think the rules of the bracket would be everyone's in their prime.
Yeah, obviously.
You know what I mean? Like, so Jack's in the prime, Jim Miller, Dan Severn. Yeah, yeah. Gary Goodridge. Like, you know, that would be a pretty good tournament. In fact, I mean, we might be able to arrange this with the budget. We're rolling in lately.
Yeah, yeah. I was checking the bank, Scott. I really think we should get the neighboring island next to Fight Island that UFC is buying.
There's an island up the street from me where there are houses and stuff. Maybe we can do it.
Yeah, I mean, but I think we should be right close to it so we can mock them as our tournament's going on. Now, granted, we can't go into the past and get all our guests in their prime, but
right.
You know, it'd still be great if we could just like point and laugh at Dana White as we sit back and go, oh wait, there's no electricity on our island or food.
Sharon Alexander. Oh man, we got a lot of tough people up in here. By the way,
Side note, the UFC, pay-per-view the other night, phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Fantastic, man. Put on a really good card. The weirdness of no one being there kind of faded by, like, the second fight. And honestly, I didn't even notice it by, like, the third fight. Like, I was kind of like, well, it's a fight. And, like, the production was exactly the same. There was just no, like, crowd noise. But it did bring in, like, a second element, a different element of, like, you could hear the punches hitting. You could hear them breathing. You could hear their coaches calling out everything. It was kind of like if you watched, The Ultimate Fighter. It was kind of like that, where you could hear their coaches. And at one point, one of the fighters said that he heard Daniel Cormier, who was announcing it, say something during an intermission. It was like, oh, yeah, I should do it. So he heard the announcers announcing, which I thought was really fascinating. But my God, was it a good card.
Now, with all your interests in it being quiet and no fans, I heard there... Joe Buck came out, and I'm not sure like how much of a joke this is or this is serious. He talked about if the NFL season goes with no fans, which will likely be, that Fox is going to A, pump in noise, and B, this is the craziest thing, like CGI a crowd.
I think it's the dumbest thing ever. I think that kind of mentality just craps on history. Because listen, this is a historic time. You're going to remember, I'm going to remember that Justin Gaethje Ferguson fight. One, because it was an amazing fight, or the Francis Ngannou knockout, which is, he's the most terrifying man in the world, by the way. But also, I'm going to remember because there was no crowd there, and it was a pay-per-view that was put on during a pandemic. You know, like, you're going to remember... Hey, remember that Redskins season where there were yet again 8-8 or 7-9? And
all we gotta do is root for one game to not be played. There have been two Super Bowl seasons that were shortened. Two Super Bowl championships went to DC.
Okay.
So all we gotta hope for is Fauci to go, all right, we can play football. But not have week one on September 13th. Throw that out the books. Then it's like, game on.
I think the crowd stuff, like the fake, is lazy. I think it's lazy of the announcers. It's lazy of the production. UFC, for every time the fight was over, they had a million videos going on and interviews and stuff that kept the viewer very, very invested. And I think the crowd noise stuff is just, it's lazy. You guys can't report enough you can't do enough to keep people involved in the game. Like, are you really missing the guy with the stupid defense sign? You know, two guys with a defense sign behind the field goal thing. Or can you address, like, I loved how Rogan and Cormier did it. They were like, this is really weird. Like, they addressed the elephant in the room. They're like Rogan was like, I don't understand why I have to be tables apart from Daniel Cormier, but yet when we're doing the stand-up interview part, we're on top of each other. You know, like, he was like, yeah, it's a little weird, but they were so into it by like a fight or two, you did not feel the difference. And I thought that's the way to do it. You never, with stuff like that, you never just, ignoring the elephant in the room is the worst thing, I think. Like, hey, yeah, there's no crowd, blah, blah. Like, and they were like, can you imagine if there was a crowd right now? How crazy. They were like, I'm so excited right now. I think fake crowd, everyone checks out. Everyone's like, well, this is stupid.
Yeah, yeah. And then they're going to have to be special for Washington and put in a fake crowd that's all the opponent's team,
right,
fan. So
it'd be funny if, like, Washington's playing and there's like, and they just start sucking real bad. And they're like, dude, we're not used to these away conditions. Like, the game was home, guys. The game was home.
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't see the pay-per-view, or I saw the highlights of it. Looked pretty good.
It's really good.
I mean, so far, they got marks because they caught somebody with coronavirus, and they shot him off the card. Yep. So that was a good thing. So it's all a matter of proving and all. And now it's coming Sunday. NASCAR is the next sport to get in there. They're going to be running a race this Sunday.
So I guess the real concern is the pit crews, I guess, is the concern, right? Because the guys are kind of alone.
Well, here's kind of the things they're doing. Since they're only going to run one race a day, like all the other ones, like the Xfinity, the trucks, they would all run on separate days. What they're going to do is you go in the garage. There's no practice or qualifying. They're drawing to see who starts a race in what position. That means extra space around. So basically, it's you're going to have your little area to work on the cars. The drivers, their RVs, they go in a separate area itself, so they'll kind of be separated out.
Right.
All the crew members will have to wear masks. Anybody caught without it will be escorted out, and apparently will get a $50,000 fine.
Jeez. I would have been fined 100 times already. I was in Lowe's today. I'm like I was dying, and I just like taking a couple breaths because I was suffocating. Sorry, guys. Sorry.
Scott, you ruined our sponsorship with the 66 team. We paid $2,000 for that, and then you cost us $200,000.
Dude, I started like hyperventilating in those masks a little bit, but a couple breaths never hurt nobody.
Well, the big thing that they're going to be doing different is the spotters. So if you watch a regular race, like they're all four corners will have spotters, and the guys are like right up next to each other. They have to space it out and allow them to see the track, but not be 6 feet apart. So it will be interesting how everything works out. And as you were saying, with the crew members, like the pit crew, along with their helmets, they will have to wear masks under the helmets to keep everybody safe, because they don't have a guard on top of the helmet.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I mean, for the amount of time the pit crew like works, like how fast they work, I don't think it's going to be that big of a problem. I mean, I'm just talking what I know about it, but you know, maybe it slows them down a little bit or whatever. But I think racing is another sport that can be done really well during this. Like, I think they can keep, you know. UFC works so well because think about the production of UFC. You see the crowd basically between rounds and before fights and after fights. The actual fight is basically a camera with two people on it, you know, two people fighting. And that's what you kind of want to see, and change angles of those two people fighting. You're not really relying on the crowd. You know what's going to be really tough? Baseball is going to be tough for them. Like, it's so much downtime.
For what I've heard, like I'm hearing the early stuff, like they're gonna recommend expanding the teams to 50 players.
Yep.
So since there's gonna be no crowds, instead of using the dugout, they'll literally be sitting in the stands, separated out. But in the end, I mean, it's gonna be weird. Like, you get a guy in a rundown, you're gonna get within 6 feet of him.
Yeah,
so it's going to be interesting.
But I meant more with like the no crowds. Like, UFC worked perfectly fine without a crowd. Baseball's like, you know, there's a lot of like like crowds. Like, you know, there's a lot of time sometimes between pitches and hit. Like, there's going to be a lot of silence for the announcers to fill.
Well, they'll probably pump in some noise or whatever. I'm kind of surprised they're saying they're using the home fields. I don't think that's going to work. I think they got to do what they're originally thinking, like some in Florida, some in Arizona, some in Texas.
This is why the Marlins are going to win the World Series this year. They've been used to this forever.
Them and the Rays, man. A-Rod versus the Rays.
No, I think NASCAR will be perfectly fine. I think it'll be entertaining for the people who watch it. I think a lot of people who have nothing left to watch are just going to watch it too. So you might get some new fans out of it. And I think pumping crowd noise, lazy. Like, do your job and make creative enough stuff to try to keep the viewer entertained. Don't rely on like fake crowd. No one's like, oh, that sounds crazy. You know, like that's crazy. It's crazy over there in Seattle.
Well, I'll enjoy when they do the Philadelphia crowds and they have to do CGI batteries thrown at players and,
exactly,
you know, middle fingers and racial slurs, items like that, you know, that really brings in the Philly crowd, you know?
So I wanted to just track back for a second. I was talking about the dickering, Mike, the dickering for items and whatnot, selling and trading and whatnot. And it reminded me of how much I still, even to this day, we'll look at like the Facebook free ads or the Craigslist ads just to see kind of what's out there and whatnot. I know you said your brother kind of does, like, you know, he finds things and sells and whatnot. So he might identify more with this. But Berlo, I thought maybe we could do a little, if you were a dickerer and like on the show, they're like, you know, that's how a dickerer does. We're going to take this and sell for profit and move it and this and that. I thought maybe we'd hit the Facebook classifieds real quick.
Okay.
And what I wanted to do, I had two things. I mean, I wanted to show you some things that people have put on Facebook before. But I think what I'm going to do only, Berlo, is just because we've been... Well, okay, real quick. So people, some things you can find on Facebook before are... 6 ounces of water for $56. Someone once sold. People sold their soul. A piece of pizza with a bite out of it. A half-empty bottle of Coke. Things like this go on the Facebook. But, Berlo, what I'm going to ask you to do, okay?
Okay.
So it's kind of like a little game. You're going to give me a number, and that's going to be the row of four things on the Facebook free marketplace by me.
Okay.
And we're just gonna talk about what item you would choose to try to turn a profit and what your thought, like how you would go about trying to maybe sell these and get onto the next thing. Because a big part, Berlo, of dickering is, all right, well, I'm gonna take this chair I found and sell it and trade it in for a couch, and then I'm gonna trade that for a motorcycle. I'm gonna so I want to see what maybe like what you would pick out of the four free items. And then maybe like what your mindset is a little bit. Are you down with that?
Let us begin.
All right, Berlo, pick a number 1 through 10.
Lucky number 5.
All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, Berlo. See, I think this is a good, easy one to start with, too.
Okay.
Because the stuff that's free here is pretty... I think there's one that stands out. Okay. Berlo, in this category, you have free pillows for a couch. Free couch pillows. Okay.
Okay.
A free storage cabinet. And I'll give... It looks like kind of like a cabinet that you would put those little baskets in. You know what I mean? Like,
okay.
All right. A free broken gas dryer, so a dryer, and a free wave runner.
Wave runner, okay.
All right. So which of those would you start your? Let's say you had a goal of like getting to $1,500. Which one would you start your journey with?
Okay, go over the list one more time for me.
All right, free pillows, couch pillows, free gas dryer. Broken. It says broken. So, like, you got to replace a part or whatnot. But remember, a big part of dickering, Berlo, is, hey, all I got to do is repair that pot. You know, like, I just got to pay that pot and put it in and sell it again. We're good, you know. You got to talk like that, too. Storage cabinet or a wave runner?
A wave runner. And that's, like, a fully functional wave runner?
All right, let me click. It just says... It's a 2000 Yamaha Wave Runner. Exterior color is white. Free Wave Runner 4 years ago. No paperwork. No paperwork on the Wave Runner, Berlo.
I would definitely go for that. Especially considering what's going on. Like the second things break open, people are going to try every insane category out there. So I think I'm going to get the free wave runner, put a little money into it, like change some spark plugs or whatever, make sure it's running fresh, and then turn around and sell it for a few. Probably I'll put the value a little lower, maybe sell it for like $100, $200 somewhere in that ballpark.
I think that's the right move. Berlew, I'm 100% with you. If we were dickering partners, you would be like Codfish, and I would be like Tony Bennett.
You're not so bad there, Coddy. Good job, good job.
Dude, I have no idea why I like the show. I have no idea. But all I can say, Berlew, is just watch an episode so we can at least talk about it next next week. But yeah, I would go with the Wave Runner, or I would go with the broken dryer. Because if we could fix the dryer, like we could probably maybe get like one. What are we gonna get for pillows? $10
Nothing.
$10
Like, but the only thing I could see using that for is if you have like an old couch at home you're willing to sell. If it's the same color scheme, it might add to the value. But
yeah, I'm not into used couches or used mattresses. I would take your used couch, Mike, because I know you, but I'm not into like someone else's used couch that I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, some stranger, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like if you were like, hey, I got this couch, like it was in my basement or whatever, I'd be like, okay, yeah, no problem. That's cool. But I don't know. All right, bro. No. Pick a number between 1 and 10 that is not 5.
9.
Okay. All right, cool. All right, bro. And your... This one's a little tougher. Okay. This is way better than the other one. Okay. So, Berlew, you have free women's winter items. Okay.
Okay.
Now, I will click on the picture and explain them to you. They are one pair of fingerless gloves.
Okay.
Two pairs of, like, kind of cloth gloves, you know, like regular gloves. And then one pair of what looks like leather gloves. And those pink things that you strap to your feet, like the that keep you from slipping on the ice. The ones with the little, like, you strap them on your shoes.
Okay.
So that's all that's shown in the picture. It says free items, free winter women's items. Okay?
Okay.
All right. A free wedding planner, Mike. It is a free brand new wedding planner. I'm clicking on the pictures, and it's just like one of those books, that, you know, with a calendar and a, you know, it's not written in. It's got suggestions for the bride, stuff like that. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, free scrap wood and two wood doors. Okay. It's looking like, I don't know, not a lot of scrap wood, like a box full, like a normal size box. And then... Okay. Two old school wooden doors. They look like they could use a paint job. Okay. And the fourth thing, Mike, free Elmo baby shoes, size 3. Free. They are white high tops with Elmo waving on the side.
Size 3. Okay.
All right. So to recap, you have the women's items, the planner, the scrap wood and two wood doors, or the baby shoes.
I'm going with the door and the wood. Okay. And my thought process is I'm going to use the wood. I'm going to basically, you know, scrap down the door, you know, put some varnish on it, maybe glue the wood to it and make it a coffee table. So I would have two coffee tables that's like kind of unique retro. Like, I'd even have, the, like, the doorknob on there because it's almost like a gimmicky thing to kind of look at it. You know what I mean? It's not just, oh, I had some wood that looked like a door.
Yeah.
My coffee table is literally a door.
I don't hate it.
And maybe even if I have enough wood, maybe put some compartments under it so maybe I can open that door a little bit. And then it's like, that's where I hide my remotes and stuff like that. I think it looked really good in, you know, some hippie kind of household or something like that. I think it would be a unique item, and that's what I do with it.
Don't hate it. In fact, the other items, not much, no chance. So I'm thinking you're giving yourself a chance. And like old doors, people are into old doors, even if you can get like $25 maybe for one. I think, Mike, I think you're dickering well. All right, Mike, one more before we go. We can always play this game again down the line because I kind of like it. Berlew, pick a number.
Let's go with number 1, Scott.
Ooh. All right, let me scroll up. All right. right, all right, all right, all right. Okay, all right. So free Casio keyboard, Mike. A free Casio keyboard. Description at all. It just said 6 hours ago it was listed. Free Casio keyboard. Looks kind of old. It's on a stand. That's it.
All right.
Okay. Next, you got a free at curb. And at the curb is a it's a thing that a baby could sit in that looks like a bike, but the parent pushes it from behind. You ever see those? Like,
okay.
Like the kid has little pedals he puts his feet on, but the parent is really pushing it from behind. Okay. Then you have the third item, Mike. It's okay. Free, free frog memorabilia.
Frog memorabilia.
Yeah, I'm going to have to send you this picture. But, Mike, it's a frog glass that says kiss me with a frog popping out of it. It's a frog, a couple things for your garden for frogs. It's a frog with a Santa outfit, so I know your wife would like that. It's a frog teapot. It's a frog, it looks like a salt and pepper shaker, and it looks like a frog Valentine's Day thing. So frog memorabilia, Mike.
Okay.
All right. And the fourth one, books for free. Okay. And I'm going to read the three I see right now. So 50 ways to yay, 50 ways to yay, a book by Deepak Chopra, the doctor, Big Fat Goals. And I see one more, How to Be a Person in the World. You should get that. You need that book. So Berlo, again, to recap, you have the Casio keyboard, the biker thing, the frog memorabilia, or the books.
Ooh, that's a tough set right there.
Not great. It's not great. It's not a great deal. Set,
so I have to just go by what I'm going to get a few extra dollars for. And I'm going to say the frog memorabilia because I can break up the set.
I agree
with you.
Sell
each piece individually and make up some funds off of that. Books, they're free everywhere. There's no way really you could change it around to sell it.
Nope.
Bike sounds nothing original where I can get any real gains for it. And same. What was the first item again?
The first item was a Casio keyboard.
Yeah, those are all single objects, whereas when you get a set of stuff,
yes,
I can attack people who have, like, very special collections and all. There are people who have very weird salt and pepper shakers. There are people who collect very numerous teapots, so I can go into that market instead of worrying about the frog people, and I feel... It's so unique. It's like, yeah, I don't have that. I want that.
I think that's a great answer,
at least
Mike.
Get the minimal answer money from it versus anything else.
I also think, say you grab 20 frog pieces, right? And even if you get $3 a piece for these, you just made $60.
Exactly.
Right. So, Mike, I agree with all three of your answers. In fact, it started making me dream up a little Rebel Shenanigans challenge here.
Okay.
Maybe we could find what's free around us, pick up one item, and see if we can make money off of
it. Resell it.
Yeah, resell it. Yeah, yeah. I have to say, you might have to give me some odds because I feel like in Georgia might be a little bit might be a little bit more of that going on, trading and selling. But I think we could have radio gold here. We could have dickering gold, Mike. So I'm going to ask you maybe before the next episode or episode or two, I would need you to watch an episode of Downey's Dickering and start perusing the free Douglas. What is it, Douglasville? You're in? Yeah.
Douglasville. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Just look around a little bit on the free and let's start getting like a little idea of what's out there.
All right, I'd be down with that.
It'd be kind of fun.
I guess we'll have to figure out the rules as in where we're selling it on or whatever.
Yeah. I think we can discuss that next week, but I think it'd be kind of a funny idea. And see who, and it should be who can turn the highest percent profit, not the, you know, like,
yeah,
because if you have a, I don't know,
if I bought a $100 item and sold it for $150 and you got a $5 item and sold it for
$8,
$100,
yeah. Right? Yeah. So I don't know, it's something to play with. Maybe it'd be fun to, we could dick it, we could look at things and whatnot, but Mike, there's no more debating or selling or anything. This episode is over. So anything promote before we get the hell out of here?
Promoting local businesses. I will do a pretentious beer company in Knoxville, Tennessee. When I was on my vacation last year, I went over there, highly enjoyed the brews there. Very fun environment. I'm trying to think of what the... I had a few IPAs and red ales. Okay, here I go. One of my favorites was the Ian Malcolm, which was a red ale. I'm huge on red ales, and it was very delicious. Also had their pretentious mangled cherry, which was very good.
That was also your nickname in high school, right?
Very much so. I was the mangled cherry. When
the pretentious mangled cherry. Here he comes.
Well, I accepted mangled cherry, but the pretentious, I was like, whoa, hold on. But in all seriousness, they have to-go options for you. It was a very enjoyable experience going there. So check out Pretentious Beer Company in Knoxville, Tennessee.
All right. And I will promote a friend of mine. We visited them recently, for New Year's Eve. Yeah, up in Canada. A good friend of mine, he was on the Jamaican bobsled.
Joe Rogan?
The Canadian bobsled team. My good friend Joey Nemeth, he's doing training in Canada, strength training, speed training, personal training, and times are tough for these people. So I want to promote SL, ACCEL, performance training. And Joey's a great guy. He's debating on whether or not to really go into the next Olympics and whatnot, but it's a tough decision because it's a lot of sacrifice. So go check out Accel Training. And that's it, guys. Life is funny. Well, I guess real quick, listen to us, share us, leave reviews, tell us we're idiots. Dicker with us. We'll do anything you want. But please, listen to the podcast. That's the most important thing. And support all your local podcasts. Guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Bye-bye.
Degrees ahoy.